Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon, listeners. It is a beautiful spring day in Fairfax, Virginia. You are listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, and this is Military Monday. This is your host, John Gresham, and I hope you enjoyed a wonderful Armed Forces Day over the weekend. We are going to go and give you a great show today because it is, in case you are not aware of it, we are coming up on the 70th anniversary of Operation Overlord, the invasion of Europe, commonly called D-Day. D-Day was an event which was one of the largest undertakings ever done by a multinational coalition. You would go and have to move forward half a century almost to 1991 to find anything that challenged it on the scale of the numbers and the size of the operation. And much like Desert Storm, half a century later, it was documented very, very scrupulously. The Allies made a point, and this came from the very top of the command chain, Dwight Eisenhower, that Overlord would be documented both photographically and on motion picture film to the greatest degree possible. And to this degree, camera operators, combat camera teams, and photojournalists from commercial news agencies and outlets were in the front lines of Overlord, be it dropping in with the paratroops the night before D-Day on June 6th, as well as aboard the landing craft as they approached the landing beaches. Now, by this time in World War II, the primary contributor to the Allied effort in Europe was the United States. Britain had held the line for many, many years, especially after the invasion of the France and the Low Countries in 1940. But by 1944, most of the men, most of the weapons, most of the equipment, and frankly, most of the supplies were coming across the Atlantic from America. And it's appropriate that as we come up on the 70th anniversary of D-Day, that a book come out that talks not only about showing the pictures that were taken during the initial landings in Normandy, but also explaining something of the people and the processes that put it together. Our guest today is Martin Morgan. If you find that name at all familiar, it's because you may have seen him on documentary films regarding the military. Also, he's a well-known tour guide and has led tours throughout the battlegrounds of Europe. And we're going to talk about his new book from Zenith Press called The Americans on D-Day. Martin, are you there?
I am. Good morning from southern Louisiana.
And I hope it's a gorgeous spring day there and not quite yet the dog days.
It's starting to get hot, though. That's the problem.
Well, this is just remember, you've always got winter to look forward to. Marty, you have put together what can only be described as a stunning tour de force of photos documenting the American invasion of Normandy on D-Day. Why'd you do it? What drove you to go on this search for the best of photographs about the U.S. effort on D-Day?
Well, first of all, I was compelled forward by a love for history that just doesn't seem to wane as the years go by. But then secondly, I'm a really visual person, and my experience in working in some television programs has always kind of inclined me toward looking for the best visual assets to support a story. I had written another book 10 years ago about D-Day, and that kind of set the stage for assembling a very large number of photographic images related to the invasion. And after I published that book and time went by, I continued to collect images related to the invasion, and I found ways to assemble them into a bigger picture, kind of telling a story. And in this case, I focused on the American experience in D-Day, and simply because I had the most images related to that, and also because of the fact that there are some pretty strenuous copyright and use fees associated with using British, Canadian, and German images. And so to make this project possible, I assembled this 450 images related to the American side of the D-Day invasion, and I decided I'd assemble it into one nice big picture book that would serve more than just a passing function of providing an illustrated history, but I was hoping, too, that I would contribute to the scholarship of the Normandy invasion by identifying some exact locations where some famous photographs were taken. So I'm presenting both the unfamiliar and familiar in a new light.
We'll talk more about how you actually built the book, and trust me, this thing looks like a major construction effort if you're talking in literary terms. But let's talk about combat photography and photojournalism during World War II, if you don't mind. And let's make it very clear to them, this is not photography as the vast majority of people know it today. Digital wasn't even invented back then. This was film-based photography, right?
Right, all of it.
For those of you who have never dealt with film-based photography, and it's kind of amazing that we've lived long enough that there's a whole generation of young people who don't even know what photographic film is anymore, this is basically a plastic, a piece of plastic long, depending upon the size. It's measured by its width, 35 millimeter being the favorite for a very long time of journalists and such. On top of it is a chemical strata, usually composed of some form of silver, which is sensitive to light. And once it's exposed in the camera, it's run through a developing bath, a photographic process, a chemical process, which goes and allows the image to be produced. So here we are. This is the state of the art, technically speaking, in World War II. What kinds of cameras did the effort on D-Day get documented by? If you'll run down some of the more popular models and what they were like.
Well, sure. The most popular, or I should say the cameras that were used the most, were the two types of cameras that were being issued to U.S. Army photographers that went in on June 6th. And for still photography, that would be the Graflex Speed graphic camera. And then for motion picture photography, that would be the Bell & Howell IMO 35mm motion picture camera. And so the camera operators that went in very often went in carrying both. Some of them did. In fact, one of the people that I focus on in the book, a photographer from the 165th Signal Photographic Company of the U.S. Army, a photographer by the name of Reuben A. Weiner, he jumped in with the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Airborne Division. He jumped with both a Bell & Howell IMO and a Graflex Speed Graphic.
And what were the virtues of these two cameras in terms of field photography under combat conditions?
Well, first and foremost, compactness, so that the Bell & Howell IMO, for example, could shoot motion picture photography, but it was in a small enough package that a single operator could carry the camera with a handheld mount. And so you didn't have to have multiple people associated with operating one camera. You could have an individual operator that could move from subject to subject and shoot his broad, his intermediate, and his close-up shots. that compactness is what really made the IMO such a popular camera. The speed graphic camera, which had been adopted by the Army some years before World War II started, was great because it shot really nice, it's a sharp, large format prints, and it could produce a great deal of detail. And that camera, although not compact like we think of compact by today's standards, it was, by the standards of the day, one of the most compact high-resolution cameras that was on the market.
And it shot, what, a 2.25 by a 2.25 negative?
That's correct.
And for those of you who have never shot film, as I have throughout most of my life, that is roughly 4 times the size of a 35-millimeter negative, and that just means lots and lots of pixels, if you think in digital terms. That's a vast amount of information on a single negative, and despite the limitations of lens technology, would produce, as you said, a beautiful still photograph.
Right. In fact, on the frontis of my book is this absolutely extraordinary photograph that was taken overlooking one of the beach exits on Omaha Beach, and it's taken a few days after D-Day, and the photograph was taken from on top of the bluff looking down, and in the photograph you can see several dozen LSTs that have beached and are unloading vehicles, and you can spend an hour easily just trying to identify different types of vehicles that are unloading on the beach and examining all of the details on the LSTs and the very low-altitude barrage balloons that are hovering in the air above it. That photograph, which occupies the entire frontis of my book and also a full-page spread in the center of the book, that was shot with one of these speed graphic cameras with the 2.25 by 3.25 negatives, and it was only because of that large format that you could get enough resolution and enough detail to reproduce that photograph at that size.
And this is one of the reasons why if you go to College Park, Maryland, and the National Archives, you say, let me see your best D-Day photographs, that one is almost inevitably stuck in front of your nose as a researcher.
Exactly. I'm glad that you brought that up. You have the experience I have of having gone to the still photograph branch at College Park, which I think is on the fifth floor. But when you go there, they already have a folder that they put together of all of the best prints associated with the D-Day invasion. For my book, I used all of those. I used all of them, even though they're photographs that we have all seen a million times, photographs that are extremely familiar. I used those, and I tried to produce at least some added quality to them by identifying exact locations, identifying the photographer that shot the image. And in this way, I hope to contribute to the scholarship on the subject by at least placing that familiar image in its proper context. But in addition to those photos that would be available to any researcher in the D-Day file of College Park, I'm also reproducing a large number of images that I believe people have not seen before in the book.
Now, let's talk a little about film, because by this time, black and white film technology was pretty mature, and photographers obviously had a range of choices between high-speed film, similar to what we would have called Tri-X in the day, as well as slower 100-speed film that provides better grain and detail. But most of the photos appear to all be black and white at a time when other parts of World War II were being regularly photographed and filmed in color. Why is it that we see so much color out of the Pacific War compared to this period in the European theater?
It's because the United States Navy and the U.S. Marine Corps invested in film stock at a later time than the Army did. And when they went to spend money on film stock, there was already an abundant supply of a commercially available full-color film. The Army had already made a very large purchase of an enormous stockpile of black and white motion picture film that was still being used throughout World War II. The Navy and the Marine Corps, though, making their purchase at a later time, bought all color. And it's for that reason that you see this really luscious and very rich color film footage of some of the most famous Pacific battles. And it's led people in some cases to just assume that there has always been a large quantity of color footage. I know that having worked on a couple of major television documentary programs that featured color film footage, it was always very awkward for me to explain to producers at television networks that there's very, very limited footage of D-Day to begin with, and very limited, even more limited, color footage of D-Day. So that whenever you see color footage of D-Day, that's always the Navy that's shooting it. It's not the Army. There's really only one Army motion picture photographer that did any amount of color shooting. It's this guy, George Stevens, but he doesn't get much combat footage. What you see,
and this, of course, is the famous, and later on, of course, George Stevens becomes a very well-known Hollywood director, but during World War II, during the invasion, he, of course, ran an Army photographic unit.
Right, and they went out, and they got a stockpile of color footage.
Hello, Martin. Are you there? Hello, Martin. We apparently are having some sort of technical problem with Martin.
I hit mute on the phone by mistake. Excuse me. I'm back now.
Oh, hey, listen. I still make mistakes here with the board more than you'd know. And as I like to describe it, sometimes there's just a loose nut in front of the keyboard.
Right. I'll take a precaution and make sure that doesn't happen again now. So sorry about that.
But in addition, the Army also liked black and white because it was so easy to process. It's only a three-step chemical process to go and process black and white, and can be done under very austere and expeditionary conditions, even in the back of a truck, as compared to the process of going and developing Kodachrome, which of course was the first real color film that was used in large stock quantities.
Right. In many ways, the black and white film just made a lot of sense for the Army. The Army already had a lot of it. It was easier to develop, and it was easier to copy and distribute. And so that's why when we see footage of D-Day from the Army side, we see black and white footage. But what we see out of that footage really stands as kind of a typical snapshot of combat photography during World War II, and that is you get a very little bit of actual footage in combat, and then you get a lot of footage in the rear with the gear. You get a lot of footage behind the lines or maybe of the aftermath of a battle. You don't get that much that captures the essence of combat in Normandy. And then also on top of that, we have this added reality with the Normandy invasion specifically, that there's plenty of footage showing June 6, 1944, so that we had everyone online. All of the photographers were online and were working. And so we've got an ample amount of coverage of the beach, the two American beaches, Utah and Omaha. And we've got a little bit of footage showing the airborne drop zones and landing zone areas. But then as time goes by and the campaign began to exert hardships on the photographers as much as it did on the riflemen, the footage begins to trail off, and we don't have nearly as much. So there's
And we'll talk a little more here. About the actual problems that came up during the landings. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of people who shot D-Day. You just brought up one of them, George Stevens, who became a very well-known Hollywood director and producer. Who were some of the other names that were sent out there, both by the military as well as by media outlets of the day that embedded their best photographers with units? Talk a little bit about those.
Well, you may have heard of the name John Ford. John Ford, who had famously covered the Battle of Midway in 1942, he had people covering the Normandy invasion as well. In addition to that, the Army photographers, some of them had very interesting backgrounds. This one photographer that I feature in the book, Reuben A. Weiner from Los Angeles, California. Reuben had the experience of working in the film industry before World War II started. He was working for a major motion picture studio in the department that developed their production stills. So they made a major movie, they'd have a still photographer along that shot production stills. and Ruben worked in the dark room developing those negatives. It was that experience that came out at the time of his induction into the Army after the war started, and with a background in photography, was a no-brainer. The Army sent him directly into a Sigma photographic company.
You mentioned John Ford, who, interestingly enough, while obviously he was recruited as a naval officer and made a reserve captain, he actually was living within the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, the essential equivalent of the CIA during World War II, interestingly enough.
Right. Yeah, his mission was really associated with war information in a very important way, maintaining high morale for the people back home. And I could see how that that was in perfect harmony with the OSS mission.
Now, we all know also that some of the top civilian photographers were embedded with units, and it's hard not to go and bring up the story of the Life magazine photographer who is almost a household name, Robert Capa.
Right. Capa is probably the name that has been etched in D-Day photography with greater popularity than any other, and that's because of the series of very famous photographs that Capa captures shortly after 7 a.m. on Tuesday, June 6, 1944, when he landed on Omaha Beach with an assault boat team from E Company, 16th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division.
Now, we'll come back and talk a little more about Capa and his photos because, of course, there's an interesting backstory to all this. But let's talk a little bit about the plan, because there actually was an Allied plan to document the D-Day landings. Talk a little bit about the plan that was approved by no less than Eisenhower and his staff to make sure that this event was appropriately photographed and filmed.
It was recognized within the highest levels of Allied leadership that this operation would immediately be a household name around the world. And because of that, there was recognition that the people back home would want to know how the battle in Normandy was developing. With recognition for that, a plan was developed that four photographers to be a part of the initial landing and four photographers to be along every step of the way, documenting everything that was happening during the liberation of France. And that was a plan that not only included direct point of recording, but it had a trail of people that were associated with supporting the entire mission, so that you had a logistical trail of individuals that, at the very tip of the spear, recorded the incidents. They then passed their film stock back through a logistical supply line that led all the way back to studios where the film could be developed, and then that developed film could be forwarded up through sensors who would go through the film footage and the still photographs to assess whether or not they were appropriate for general release. And once they were cleared for general release, either in their uncensored or censored versions, they would be distributed through the Office of War Information through public media sources back home. And that way, this logistical line from cameraman all the way to the Office of War Information, that would swiftly disseminate the imagery from the invasion to people back home so that within days of the operation, still photographs were being released in newspapers back in the U.S., and within weeks of the invasion, they had already assembled newsreels that would play before a feature film in theaters across the nation.
And this also worked to push down to the photographers because they needed fresh supplies. They sometimes needed replacement cameras or repairs. What was the process of pushing film and other supplies, as well as extra camera gear, back down into Normandy for the photographers and film crews?
Well, this one photographer that I was with told me this really interesting story. Reuben A. Weiner, 165th Sigma Photographic Company, he jumped into Normandy as a paratrooper with the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 82nd Airborne Division. He landed with his equipment, which was a still camera and a motion picture camera, and his instructions were record everything you can, and when you use up all your motion picture and still photographic film stock, work your way down to a supply depot that will be established on Utah Beach, and at that supply depot, you'll find the 165th Signal Photographic Supply Depot on the beach, and when you get there, you turn in your exposed film, and they will then issue you new film. And it's interesting, you can see, you can almost trace the exact path that he took on a map based on the shots that he collected. So you get shots from right after dawn on D-Day. He jumped before dawn, but you get shots right at dawn of him in a little village called St. Marcoux. You can then follow him down to another village called Ravinoville, and then he ultimately shot up everything and worked his way down to Utah Beach and drew new film stock. And then from there, he went through St. Marguerite, and he went down to this place called Lafayette. You can almost follow him step by step by looking at the shots that he ultimately turned in. And he keeps working throughout the campaign. There are other photographers, like the one that's really well-known named Fred Taylor, who landed on Omaha Beach. He ends up the Fox Red sector of Omaha Beach and shoots up all of his film stock, captures priceless footage of the battle on Omaha Beach that includes probably the most famous visual image of D-Day, which is an image that Fred Taylor shot looking down on the Fox Road sector of Omaha Beach as two soldiers run up the beach, and as they're running up the beach, a bullet drops one of the soldiers in mid-stride very dramatically. When Fred Taylor shot that, he was holding his IMO camera steady with a wounded arm because he himself had been wounded during the landing. Taylor, after he used up all his film stock, he went through basically the same process that Reuben A. Weiner did over near Utah Beach, and that is that he searched around on Omaha Beach until he found the designated supply depot for the 165th Signal Photographic Company. They had a supply depot on Utah Beach and another one on Omaha Beach. He turned in film footage, drew new film stock, got his wounds treated, and then went right back into battle to continue recording.
Now, this process worked with varying levels of success. I mean, obviously, we do have process photos that were successfully taken on D-Day and, of course, the campaign afterwards. But there were also some major oopses, and we'll talk about more of those in a minute. Now, talk a little bit about the accommodations made for the civilian photojournalists, guys like Bob Capa and the others from newspapers and magazines that were going to be embedded with various units.
Right. The military granted press credentials and placed these civilian photographers with combat units. The Robert Capa story is the best one of them all. With some recognition, Capa was a very, very well-established photographer. It was decided within the command of the U.S. Army 5th Corps, which is the force that lands at Omaha Beach, to send him in, not with the absolute tip of the spear, the very, very first wave, but to send him in with an assault boat team that would land within minutes of the first wave, with the express intent, with the objective of having Capa capture some of the combat on Omaha Beach at its highest. Now, there was an assumption that Capa would be, although in a somewhat imperiled position by being with the combat troops in an assault wave, there was also a general underestimation of how intense the German opposition was going to be. And so the result is that Capa lands and captures these extremely dramatic images of troops that are attempting to shelter behind German beach obstacles, of men being washed by a rising tide. In fact, Capa takes this very famous photograph that ended up on the cover of Stephen Ambrose's book, D-Day, the Climactic Battle of World War II, of a soldier from the 29th Division as he wades through the surf. The photograph is taken of that soldier's back. So Capa was in a position to capture some of the most dramatic images of the entire invasion, and he was only in that position because the Army, before the invasion, had made the decision of allowing a civilian war correspondent to land with an assault wave.
Now, how many I guess the question that one would ask is, in terms of the two American beaches, Utah on the far western end of the invasion zone on the Carentan Peninsula, and Omaha, which was just east of it, what kind of, as well as obviously the landing grounds for the 82nd and the 101st Airborne, how many photographers and cameramen were there that were actually supposed to document D-Day on the first day, on June 6th? Do you have any sense of a count of the number of personnel involved?
Well, it's a couple dozen total that are properly equipped to do the job. But an interesting footnote to D-Day history is that not all of photographers are able to do anything. Now, there are cases like Robert Kappa, who shoots on Omaha Beach, this photographer that I feature in the book, Ruben Weiner, who jumps with the 508 Parachute Infantry and records. But, for example, there's another photographer from the same unit, 165th Signal Photographic Company, named Jimmy L. Bates. And Jimmy Bates jumped with the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Airborne Division. He just so happened to land in about 8 feet of water. So he was submerged, as well as all of his equipment, from head to toe in water, ruining all of his equipment. So this one photographer, embedded with this one specific regiment, was supposed to capture great stills and great motion picture footage, and he captured absolutely nothing. Which is interesting, because I learned this the hard way, in that I decided about a decade ago I wanted to write a book about the 507th in combat in Normandy, and I found that there was just a dearth of film images or photographs showing the 507th. And as I struggled to come to grips with that, I learned the reality of what happened to Jimmy Bates, and that is he landed, got his camera soaked, and wasn't able to do anything. And it's for that reason that there are holes in the coverage. So Ruben Weiner jumps with the 508th, and he documents them well enough. Jimmy Bates jumps with the 507th and doesn't document anything, because he can't, because his equipment's ruined.
We're going to talk about the actual combat experience of these people, both civilian and military. But first, we're going to run a couple of network messages. This is Military Monday on the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends. want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And welcome back to Military Monday. Are you still there with us, Marty?
Yes, I am.
Very good. I love it when the technology works. We're talking today about Marty Morgan's new book from Zenith Press called The Americans on D-Day, which is a tour de force of photography taken on D-Day and shortly afterwards. And Marty, let's go ahead and start telling the story of, you know, before the break we discussed everything that had been done to get ready to document this, and it obviously ran from the highest levels of the Allied command in Europe all the way down to a few dozen selected professionals who were going to be given the chance of a lifetime, admittedly, with their lives in danger doing it. Talk a little bit about how it started. You brought up the point that it was a mixed set of results coming out of the airborne landings.
That's right. So that a number of photographers jumped in with the airborne divisions, the 82nd and 101st, for the express purpose of documenting what was going on in the drop zones and landing zones. And some of them got some great footage and some great photographs. Reuben A. Weiner from 165th Signal Photographic does so for the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment. But then, in contrast, Jimmy Bates, who jumped the 507th Parachute Infantry Regiment, lost all of his equipment on the drop and wasn't able to get anything. And it's for that reason today why we have some gaps early on in the airborne landings, showing the depiction of the drop zone and landing zone areas, especially for the 82nd Airborne Division. So they were supposed to have one photographer online for each of the parachute infantry regiments that went in, and some of them weren't able to record anything at all. It's for that reason that the U.S. Army ultimately resorts to pulling stills out of single frames of motion picture footage, which is why you get some great – they do that for Reuben Weiner. They do that for some of the other photographers. You get some of the more dramatic images from the early part of the invasion in the airborne area that have a little bit of a grainy aspect to them, and that's because of the fact that they've just grabbed a frame of 35-millimeter motion picture film and blown it up into a still for release. And it's because there just weren't enough photographers that were turning in footage and turning in stills. But the most famous case is probably –
Please go ahead, Marty.
I was just getting mentioned that there's always the most infamous example of them all, this example that really narrates this reality that things don't go off as planned very often, that the enemy and nature both get to vote on how things go, and they usually vote to make your life complicated. Robert Capa, who landed in the earliest assault waves with the 1st Infantry Division on Omaha Beach, Capa steps off the ramp of his LCP into a very chaotic combat environment. He's directly under fire along with the men of the assault boat team that he landed with. He shoots as many stills as he can using a 35-millimeter camera. He then works his way ultimately to another landing craft that he climbs aboard that then takes him back out to the fleet, and he is then rushed back to England. And we know that there were almost 100 photographs, 100 exposures total in what he shot that morning on Omaha Beach in very, very intense combat, and that a technician in his haste to develop that film footage ruined most of the images.
In fact, we only have a single strip of images that he shot, although they're very compelling, obviously.
Right. I think the number's 12 images total, but they're the most dramatic images that you could imagine. And to this day, they remain the most dramatic still photographs capturing combat on Omaha Beach on the morning of Tuesday, June 6, 1944. It's difficult not to speculate about what those other photographs would have looked like. It's easy to assume that they would have been more of the same, that it would have been more of these extremely personal, extremely compelling photographs, but they are lost to posterity. We'll never know what was on them.
And these weren't the only photographs and films lost. You talk about one particularly damning loss to, of all things, the ocean itself.
Right. So the motion picture photographers and still photographers from the 166th Signal Photographic Company, who were operating off of Omaha Beach, they had their designated supply depot, and they were to shoot up, expose all of their film, and then take it down to this supply depot, turn it in. They would then be given new film stock. Well, as they turned it in, logistical train functioned like this, that the supply depot would then put it all in a duffel bag, and it would be placed on a landing craft with a note on it that was instructing the handlers where it was supposed to end up. It was in so this duffel bag with a couple dozen reels of motion picture film that was all shot on June 6, 1944, placed on a landing craft. That landing craft then travels back out to the fleet, and of course one of the most well-known aspects of the weather on Tuesday, June 6, 1944, is the fact that it was windy, that there was a storm in the English Channel, and that they had 3 to 5 foot seas. Well, in those heavy seas, that landing craft pulled up to a ship, and as that duffel bag was being transferred over, a wave crashed against the landing craft, causing it to drop quickly, and the result was that the duffel bag was dropped, it fell between the landing craft and the ship, and then sank like a rock. So that's several dozen reels of motion picture film shot on D-Day that was just lost.
Now, for all the stories of lost images, there's also stories of incredible shots that come out of it. And one of the stories you told me when we were talking the other day was about, of all things, a Coast Guard photographer aboard one of the landing craft. Talk about that.
Right. So Chief Photographer's Mate Bob Sargent was going in on Omaha Beach from a U.S. Coast Guard landing ship. He was on a U.S. Coast Guard manned LCVP.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of
Go ahead. Sorry about that.
Okay. That's all right. At any rate, Bob Sargent was going in. He was a Coast Guard photographer. He was going in at about the same time as Robert Capa, not terribly far from where Robert Capa came ashore. And he snapped a photograph of the assault boat that was in his LCVP, where you can see all the men of the boat team. They have their M1 rifles wrapped in plyofilm bags to protect the rifles from salt water and from sand. You can see the squad leader at the bow of the LCVP near the ramp. He's just taken a peek over the ramp as they approach the beach. And then just moments later, Bob Sargent shot another photograph seconds after the ramp dropped and the assault boat team stepped off the ramp into the water. And from that angle, you can see the anti-landing craft in the foreground and the members of the assault boat team as they're struggling through the surf toward the beach in the distance. And it's one of the more compelling and dramatic images that was collected on that day.
To say that it's an iconic image is something of an understatement, because as we were saying, the still cameras could capture just so much information in a single image, and the composition of this thing over and above the technical quality of it was just amazing.
Right, and it's because of that high resolution and because of the dramatic nature of the subject matter, that the Bob Sargent photograph, the second photograph, is the cover of my book. It's one of the more popular images, so it's the cover of a couple of other books that have come out this month. But at the same time, we all clamor toward that one photograph because it really gives you everything you could possibly want in terms of understanding the experience of combat on Omaha Beach on D-Day.
Not to mention, of course, as you pointed out earlier today, it's the promotional photo on my Facebook page for today's show. Now, what were some of the other photos that were notable on D-Day that you like out of your own book?
Right. Well, Reuben Weiner, who is this one photographer that jumped with the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, he went through with a squad from the 508th into a little town called Saint-Marcouf. And as he walked into that little town with this squad, he snapped a series of photographs that culminated in one where there's a group of paratroopers that are walking down a masonry wall enclosed road next to a church cemetery. And one of the riflemen had just turned around because apparently Reuben Weiner was making too much noise. And one of those riflemen had just turned around to give Weiner to shoot him an evil stare, like, you're making too much noise. That photograph is one of my favorites from June 6th. There's another great photograph that was shot in the town of St. Mary Glees itself that shows two American paratroopers as they came down the road on horses that they had commandeered from French farms. The photographer snapped one still, and then he obviously made the decision that he, after shooting one still where the two troops on horseback are at a distance, he decided he wanted to get some motion picture footage of it. And so he was rolling motion picture footage as the two paratroopers on horseback rode up closer to him, and one of those frames from that motion picture footage was ultimately pulled out. And in it, you see an 82nd Airborne Division paratrooper with his one Garand rifle across his lap, sitting mounted atop a white horse. We're Americans. We're going to be on the white horses. We're the good guys. And behind him is a French road sign that says La Mer, 6 kilometers, meaning it was just a few miles to the sea. I think that photograph is so interesting, the fact that these two paratroopers, who were obviously the victims of a misdrop, that the way that they made it to their designated assembly area was on horseback. I just love it because it shows you this adapt, just overcome quality that paratroopers were being taught even 70 years ago.
Now, we've talked a lot about the American photographers and film crews, but they weren't the only people who shot photos that are in your book. There are photos shot not only by Americans, but you tell the story of how photos from French occupation Germans show up in your book, and even that German photographic crews actually got to the coast that day.
That's right. There's this famous moment where the British landings on Sword Beach and the Canadian landings on Juneau Beach, they had not linked up their flanks just yet. They didn't do so until the following day. And so the result was that there was a gap that was developing between the Canadian 3rd Infantry Division and the British 3rd Infantry Division. And that gap was exploited by a column of vehicles from the 192nd Panzer Grenadier Regiment of the 21st Panzer Division. Well, this column pushed all the way down through this gap and pushed all the way to the beach on D-Day, and the column had a German motion picture camera operator with them, what the Germans called Kriegsberichte. And this Kriegsberichte walked out onto a stretch of beach between Sword and Juneau, and he panned to the left where you can see off in the distance some smoke rising from the very intense battle that the Canadians were having at Juneau Beach. And he even panned over to a few landing craft that had been washed by the current over to the area where they had reached the coast. It makes for some very, very interesting footage. It's footage that is often used out of context because people don't understand that there was actually a moment on D-Day where a German counterattack reached the water's edge. That counterattack ultimately withdrew before sunset that night. But nevertheless, there were Germans that were part of 21st Panzer Division that reached the beach. They didn't have tanks with them. They were just on landing craft and smaller, or they were just on half tracks and smaller vehicles, but they made it to the beach nevertheless. The Germans also had occupied Normandy for going on 4 years then, and there was a pretty interesting tourist trade built around Germans that just wanted to visit for the sake of tourism. For example, the Germans loved to stroll around in the streets of the town of Bayeux. The Germans loved to go and visit Mont-Saint-Michel, which is not terribly far from where the invasion took place. And the Germans had a network that supported this kind of tourism for their troops, so that troops could draw a pass, take a train from Gare Saint-Lazare, the train station in Paris that leads to Normandy. They could then get off and they could make use of these rest houses for German soldiers that were in Caen, in Bayeux, and in Cherbourg, where for just a few Reichsmarks, you could have a warm meal and a bed for the night. Well, the Germans had troops that were stationed in the area around the town Saint-Héraclès, and they had some troops that were just passing through on their way to see tourist sites and some troops that were stationed in the area. And when they got to Saint-Héraclès, its quaint and charming qualities intrigued them enough to where they snapped their own photographs around town. They could get them developed in a pharmacy in town. And whenever Germans brought in film to get developed, this young Frenchman that was running the developing, the darkroom, he would often make two sets of prints so that he would give them their prints back after they were developed, and then he would hang on to them. So I have this series of photographs in the book of German troops in Saint-Héraclès that were brought to light in this way. There were personal photographs shot with a small camera, probably a little Leica, but they, in this way, ended up in the hands of the French. Still don't know who the Germans are in those photos, and we don't know who the photos belonged to, but we have them, and they make for really nice then-and-now comparisons. Using photographs that were shot by official German military photographers, it's something that's very challenging because they have some pretty significant use and distribution fees associated with them, so that it's often off limits for modestly funded projects to make use of the images from the German Bundesarchive. In order to cover...
And it's worth noting that in some cases these photos were actually forwarded prior to the landings to the Allies to assist in their planning processes as well.
That's right. The underground could get photographs out in this way so that Allied forces could examine the photographs, recognizing the subtle nuances and markings on vehicles and insignia on uniforms so that they could understand who they were dealing with. But, you know, one aspect of the photography that I would like to mention now real quick is that long before the invasion came ashore, long before Tuesday, June 6th, there was already photography of the area where this battle would unfold, and that's because photo reconnaissance missions were being dispatched to Normandy. I make use of the book of a series of photographs that were snapped almost a year before the invasion, and they were photographs that were snapped by a P-38 Lightning that was a photo recon aircraft. And that just flew down the length of what would ultimately become Omaha Beach. I made use of those photographs in the book. The aerial photo reconnaissance passes also contributed meaningfully to the plan for Operation Neptune Overlord, the invasion of Normandy, in that photo reconnaissance flights in the month of May passing over the area around this French town, Saint-Hubert-le-Vicomte, in the center of the Cotentin Peninsula, a few miles to the west of Saint-Héraclès, photo reconnaissance aircraft were detecting the presence of a large number of German vehicles, and they detected what was recognized as a troop buildup. And what they ultimately figured out was that a new German division had just arrived in Normandy 1 month before the invasion. The arrival of that division, detected by photo reconnaissance missions, ultimately triggered, within days of the invasion, a complete overhaul and change of the 82nd Airborne Division's mission. The 82nd Airborne Division was originally supposed to land in the center of the Cotentin Peninsula around the town Saint-Hubert-le-Vicomte. But within days of the operation, the mission was changed so that the 82nd Airborne Division landed much closer to the beach around the town of Saint-Héraclès. And the only reason that change occurred is because of the photo reconnaissance missions.
Let's come forward 70 years to you publishing this book. Obviously, having written a few books myself and shot a few photos and embedded them into my books, this is a long, torturous, and sometimes frustrating prospect. And here you are putting 400-plus photos into a massive book. Did you have any sense of the challenge you were undertaking when you started doing this?
No, and I'm glad I didn't, because if I had had a sense of it, I probably would not have done this. If I had known how much money would ultimately be spent on things like flights around Normandy so that I could take photographs and reproduction fees and money spent on camera equipment, something you can sympathize with, I believe.
Oh,
yeah. If I'd known what I was getting into, I probably would have walked away. Gladly, that ignorance led to the publication of this book. It's been basically a decade in the making, because I tooled up to write this book 10 years ago about the 507th in Normandy. And in the process, I taught myself a little bit of some basic photography. I insinuated myself into a network of people in Normandy itself, friends that would ultimately help me get this job done. For example, one person that I became very good friends with is my buddy Jerome, who runs a shop in Bayeux, and he's also a pilot and owns an airplane that's based at Carpiquet Airport in Caen. And Jerome and I, every year for the last 5 years, would go out flying if we got a good day of weather, which is something that you don't often get in Normandy during the summer. But Jerome and I would go out flying, and I would take my camera along. And that's how I collected many of the aerial photographs showing Normandy today, which I believe contribute meaningfully to the book.
Well, I certainly do. And for those of you who have not seen this book, please go to the Zenith Press page or to Amazon and get a look at some of the quality reproductions that are in this, because it's a beautifully, beautifully laid out book. In terms of working with the publisher, how was Zenith Press to work with in terms of, you're going to give us how many photos that we have to go and put on how many pages?
Well, my vocabulary lacks the superlatives to describe the ideal situation of working with Zenith Press. I can't imagine a better publisher. Because they were always agreeable. They assigned a team to getting this book out the door that were so easy to work with, and they produced a product that is fantastic. The book's general appearance is better than I even imagined possible. The layout of the book is what was so especially impressive to me. So you had an all-hands-on-deck kind of team that approached to getting this project done. And I found the experience of working with that company to be second to none, and I hope to work with them again on another project.
And let it be said, this is the kind of book, now that I've got it, that makes me want to go out and buy a coffee table to have it on that coffee table. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. Now, you couldn't put all the pictures in that you wanted because of something you brought up earlier, and that is the question of copyrights. Talk a little to our listeners about the copyright problems with a lot of the photos, not just from commercial sources here in the United States, but also government sources in Britain, Germany, and other places.
Right. Since you mentioned Britain, I'll just start with them. The Imperial War Museum has this magnificent stockpile, this terrific selection of photographs, and I would love to be able to use them. I've spent a lot of time in that archive in London, and I would love to be able to make use of a lot of that photography. The only problem is that they charge some rather intimidating reproduction fees, but in addition to that, their publication fees, so that you have to pay them, a fee is assessed based on how many copies of a book or magazine you're going to print. I understand the economics of why they have to do that. I'm not complaining about it, but at the same time, what that does is that automatically introduces a dynamic where there are going to be projects that just can't do it. In order to put together a book like the one that I've just published through Zenith that would cover the Germans, that would cover the British, there would have to be a really healthy budget, a budget approaching probably about $50,000 to cover use fees associated with images. And for most people, those costs are simply just prohibitive. And it's unfortunate that that's the case. You also have cases of private ownership of photography. So the famous Robert Capa photos, which, by the way, do not appear in my book because I couldn't afford to pay the fees associated with them. They're administered by Magnum Photographs, and Magnum charges fees. They assess a fee based on what your project is and how many copies of your project are going to be distributed. And when I came forward with this project, I had mountains of photography that were free use public domain images. I had so much of that that I realized, hey, they're just on public domain imagery here alone, there's plenty. In fact, out of the, I've got 450 in the book, I probably had three times that that I had to pick and choose from. And that was often a painful process to go, I love this photograph, but I just, which one do I love more, this one or this one? Often had to make some serious choices about that. Another thing that I feel like is a big positive for this book is the fact that during the past 15 years I've been around, the good fortune of being around and being able to develop relationships with a very large number of World War II veterans, who also shared personal photography with me. Personal photography that for the most part were portraits showing them what they looked like at the time. And my relationships with those people made it possible for me to include images so you could see the face of an individual whose story is being told in the text right next to it. And I feel like that adds a lot, too.
So sadly, even though the Capa story of D-Day is an iconic one that we have just told again for God knows how many times, since the actual battle 70 years ago, we sadly, because of the user fees, cannot go and see any of the amazing strip of a dozen photos that he actually put out.
Right. I don't have them just because I was a flat broke grad student that was trying to get a book out, so I didn't use them. I've been involved in a number of television projects that have used the Capa photographs, and I found that for those TV projects, the use fees were actually reasonable, but reasonable can sometimes be a couple thousand dollars that I just didn't have.
Yeah, for those who are under the misguided impression that writers are independently wealthy, try again, folks. Well, we've told the story of your book and of the photographic effort on D-Day. Let's talk a little about you. You made a reference that there are other projects ahead. What are you going to do next now that you've finished this monster?
Well, I guess the next big project is going to air nationally on June 6, 2014. I'm currently working on a project that's called D-Day in HD for the History Channel that will premiere on D-Day. It's a four-hour documentary. That's on two broadcast nights, June 6th and June 7th. So keep watching your guide and tune in to D-Day in HD on June 6th. I also have other projects in the work, and I'm preparing right now to leave for the summer tour season. I'm about to fly to London to meet my first tour group to go over to be present for the 70th anniversary ceremonies in the next month.
It should be said, by the way, that one of Marty's professions is to actually lead tour groups to historic battlefields. And this is the big one. This is 70th anniversary of the Western campaign. And God, I hope it's good weather for you over there, Marty.
It never is. It never is. We always get rained on. If it's Normandy, you get rained on. If you want touring with perfect weather, go to Hawaii. But there's a magic that's associated with being on Omaha Beach on June 6th, on that anniversary, and it's something that still appeals to me and pulls at my heartstrings. And a very large number of people want to experience that, and I've just been lucky enough in life to be able to be involved travel and tour guiding. I do it all over the world. I'm leading tours all over the world around the calendar year each and every year now. But nevertheless, I always look forward to being with a group on Omaha Beach on June 6th. It's got a magical appeal that nothing can compare to.
Are you going to go and do tours up through the fall, like to the Market Garden battlefields, or this winter for the Bulge?
Yes, in fact, I'm planning a big tour for the 70th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge right now. I don't have anything for Market Garden, but I lead tours there every year. I'm leading one there next month, in fact. So I'm going to be taking, next month I take a couple of groups to the Battle of the Bulge area, but we're also building toward a very big commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge, and that's a tour experience that has the worst weather of them all.
I'm just thinking about the Ardennes in the middle of winter, and yet there are people who will pay good money to go out and literally freeze their heinies off to be in Bastogne on Christmas Day.
That's right. There's nothing that can compare to it. And from the tour guide perspective, you do a little bit of outdoor activity and a lot of indoor museum activity.
Okay. Well, buy yourself a great coat and some amazing gloves, okay?
That's for sure.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing the story of you, your book, and this effort to document D-Day. And come back and talk to us.
Well, Robert, it's been a pleasure being on, and I would love to come back on any time. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Marty, and you have a great afternoon.
All right, you too.
And that closes out this edition of Military Monday. I wanted to go and give a little shout-out to a soldier that we lost this past week. There was a sergeant who was wounded last week in Afghanistan, a Sergeant Baranis, I believe is how his name is pronounced. He had a background in special operations, and he was involved very deeply in the planning of the first successful POW rescue mission since World War II during Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. This was the rescue of Private Jessica Lynch from an Iraqi hospital after she had been captured and the unit she had been associated with was wiped out in the town of Nasiriyah. He was part of the team that actually went in and assaulted the hospital, helped bring her out, and handed her off to the crew of the helicopter that took her to safety. Sadly, we lost him. He was wounded, actually made it home to a hospital here in the States where he sadly expired. We salute him and hope that you go and remember him in your prayers as well as his family. We'll be back with another edition of Military Monday next week. Until that time, enjoy this beautiful spring and remember the people who make sure that we are able to enjoy it. Take care.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming to me. never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my.
Why he is